The pandemic's front lines may be thinner because of burnout among critical care nurses.
A new study just out today finds that the stress has left nurses feeling totally depleted, and now many are leaving their jobs.
I'm Scott Simon.
I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro, and this is Up First from NPR News.
To open his second 100 days in office, President Biden's making a new infrastructure pitch and calling for a greater government investment in passenger rail.
It makes it possible to build an economy of the future and one that we need.
Plus, today marks the beginning of the end of America's longest war. After 20 years of fighting the war in Afghanistan, U.S. troops are starting to pull out.
Please stay with us. We've got the news you need to start your weekend.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Dell Technologies Small Business Podference, a conference via podcasts that shares advice for small businesses to rise to the challenge. Tune in starting May 10th at DellTechnologiesPodference.com.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Wise. Get the real mid-market exchange rate every time you send money to 80 countries. Join over 10 million people and businesses. And try Wise for free at wise.com/NPR.
Stress and mental health issues are always high among the nation's frontline healthcare workers, including critical care nurses.
And there's a study out today that confirms that. And other recent research has shown just how much the pandemic has added to the strain.
Here to talk about this all is NPR's health correspondent, Ritu Chatterjee. Ritu, thanks so much for being with us.
Happy to be here, Scott.
What did the new study find?
So they surveyed more than 700 critical care nurses and found that 40% were struggling with symptoms of depression and 60% had symptoms of anxiety. And this was before the pandemic. And the authors think this is because of work stress from things like staffing shortages and long shifts. Here's the study's author, Bernadette Melnick at The Ohio State University.
We've known for quite some time, 12-hour shifts are related to poor health in nurses.
And yet, you know, nurses continue to have 12-hour shifts.
And the shifts have just gotten harder during the pandemic, haven't they?
Oh, absolutely. I've been talking to nurses and doctors around the country, and the first thing they tell me is just the staggering numbers of very serious COVID patients they've had to treat and just how many of them have died. Here's Molly Sullivan. She's an ER nurse at Mount Sinai Hospital, who says especially the early weeks of the pandemic were unrelenting.
It's almost like cutting a snake off Medusa's head. You can chop it off, but two more grow back. And so you might feel as though you have now completed and hopefully stabilized a patient who is now intubated. But what you missed was that three more patients came in and couldn't be seen because you were helping to intubate somebody.
And, you know, she says all of this has taken an emotional toll.
While we were in the midst of everything, it felt hopeless. It felt like life was never going to be normal again. I would never love my job again. It would only be a source of trauma and heartbreak.
Every single healthcare worker I've spoken to recently said they have felt burnt out.
And what did they say about what this kind of burnout feels like?
So it's more than just exhaustion. They talked about feeling physically and emotionally drained. They also say that they feel cynical about their jobs with little or no sense of personal accomplishment. One nurse who works at a hospital in Florida, Sarah Flanagan, she talked with me about feeling emotionally distant.
It's like a dissociative state that I was in where it was like an out-of-body experience. And my husband even recognized it. He said I wasn't present for a lot of 2020.
Flanagan says she's in therapy to help manage her anxiety and deal with insomnia and nightmares.
And Ritu, so many nurses and doctors feel burned out and they struggle with mental health. What are the implications for their patients?
It has direct consequences, Scott. The study published today shows that poor mental health in nurses increases medical errors. So, you know, that affects you, me, anyone seeking medical care. And the other big implication here is that we might see a big exodus from the workforce, and some of that is already happening. The Florida nurse we just heard from has cut back her hours significantly, and she says many of her colleagues have quit.
Is there a sense of how this can be change to make things better for critical care nurses?
Well, you know, you have to make their sort of work lives better. One solution the nurses propose is give them shorter shifts and hire more people. Also, they want their own wellness to be a priority. So Melnick's research suggests that if healthcare workers think their employers care about their wellness, they're more likely to be in better mental and physical health.
NPR's Ritu Chatterjee, thanks so much.
Thank you.
President Biden concluded a big week of his still early presidency at a place he knows rather well, and that is an Amtrak station. And against that backdrop, he talked about trains, of course.
President Biden was celebrating half a century of Amtrak service and reminisced about his thousands of train trips, but he was also there to sell his ambitious spending and infrastructure plans.
While capping off 100 days in office, the president is pushing for trillions in new government spending that would reshape the economy and help cut down on climate-changing emissions. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordóñez was traveling with the president, and he joins me now. Hello.
Hello, Lulu.
Franco, this was the start of Biden's second 100 days in office. Why mark the milestone that way?
Well, you know, he's out making the case for, as you guys noted, the huge spending programs he's talked about in his speech Wednesday to Congress. He went to Philadelphia yesterday to mark Amtrak's 50th anniversary. Of course, Biden is Amtrak's most famous rider. He traveled by train to Washington from his home in Wilmington every day when he was a senator. And he used the train almost as a metaphor to explain why spending on infrastructure is important.
It has been part of my life. I've been riding an Amtrak for almost as long as there's been an Amtrak. I've come to see that Amtrak doesn't just carry us from one place to another. It opens up enormous possibilities. And especially now, it makes it possible to build an economy of the future and one that we need.
The reality, though, is, you know, these plans are going to be really tough to get passed in Congress. So he's going to take some time to, you know, talk to Americans and try to build support and pressure on those in Washington.
Franco, infrastructure is really just one part of presidential plans. You know, he talked about a lot of other things in his speech to Congress. How likely is it that that legislation will actually come together?
Yeah, right. You know, what he was talking about yesterday was his proposed $2 trillion plan for infrastructure and jobs. And this week, he added another $1.8 trillion in spending and tax cuts for what he's calling the American Families Plan. This includes universal pre-K, child care subsidies, paid leave, and 2 years of free community college. He's proposing to pay for all this with tax hikes on big corporations and the most wealthy Americans. You know, these ideas poll well, but Republican lawmakers are not comfortable with this idea of expanding government, raising taxes, and redistributing wealth. Top Republicans like Mitch McConnell have said Biden has pulled a bait and switch in campaigning like a moderate who wants bipartisan deals, but then pushing these big liberal packages.
Okay, with 100 days under his belt, though, what will Biden's next 100 days look like?
Well, he's going to meet with lawmakers to talk about his ideas. He says he's willing to negotiate, and there are some signs of that already happening. We expect he'll meet this coming week with a group of Republicans who are open to a smaller infrastructure deal. On Monday, Biden's going to Yorktown, Virginia, to talk about his ideas for investing in education. But next week, he'll also talk about the next phase of the fight on COVID-19. He's going to give a speech on this Tuesday. And he took the step yesterday of banning most travel from India because of the surge in coronavirus cases. So the pandemic, of course, is still a present problem as he looks toward rebuilding for the future.
That's NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordóñez. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Today marks the beginning of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. The pullout starts some 20 years after U.S. troops toppled the Taliban government because it harbored al-Qaeda and its leader Osama bin Laden, who plotted the attacks of 9/11.
On Wednesday, President Biden used his speech to Congress to say it is well past time for the U.S. troops to come home.
We have service members in Afghanistan who are not yet born on 9/11. The war in Afghanistan, as we remember the debates here, were never meant to be multi-generational undertakings of nation-building.
For more, NPR's Tom Bowman joins us. He, of course, has spent many years reporting in Afghanistan, often embedding with U.S. forces. Tom, thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, Scott.
Of course, May 1st was the date all U.S. and NATO troops were supposed to be out under the agreement that the Trump administration signed with the Taliban last year. What happened?
Well, there was a debate within the government for weeks about whether to keep the remaining 2,500 U.S. troops in the country to push the Taliban to have serious negotiations with the Afghan government about the country's future, and also to get the Taliban to break with al-Qaeda. Scott, negotiations have been on and off, of course, and the Taliban have not broken with al-Qaeda. Now, American military leaders wanted the troops to stay with no explicit timeline. Biden, as we just heard, said no, enough is enough.
Tom, are defense officials worried about the safety of U.S. troops as they leave and the risk of attacks by the Taliban?
Yeah, there's a lot of worry, and that's why an aircraft carrier, the Eisenhower and B-52 bombers, were sent to the region. It'll take a few months to get all the troops out. I'm hearing maybe by July. And the Taliban are increasing attacks on Afghan forces, but have not attacked U.S. or NATO troops. But, you know, that could change with some Taliban commanders maybe eager to kick the foreign troops out the door. There's worry about that. U.S. military has said if the Taliban attacks, they'll be hit very, very hard. Now, Scott, another worry is some Afghan troops could turn their weapons on U.S. and NATO troops. Already, the so-called insider attacks have risen dramatically among Afghan government forces. A U.S. government report found the Afghan troops or police killing their own was up 82% from January through March compared to last year. Get this, 115 killed, 39 wounded.
Tom, and what do people at the Pentagon say about the fate of the Afghan military and Afghanistan itself as U.S. and NATO forces depart?
Well, there are still a lot of unanswered questions. Besides foreign troops leaving, thousands of civilian contractors will leave as well. And they're doing most, if not all, of the maintenance on Afghan military vehicles and aircraft. Some are saying, as a result, the Afghan Air Force could be grounded in just a few months. Although Pentagon officials say, listen, we're trying to come up with some sort of innovative ways to help with the maintenance. The big concern overall, a possible civil war as the Taliban gain ground and try to threaten cities such as Kabul.
As we noted, Tom, you've spent many years reporting this story from Afghanistan. What do you hear from soldiers and officials about the administration's decision to get out?
Well, Scott, there are mixed views. Some say it's time to leave, and it's for the Afghans to sort things out. Some are saying you can't abandon the country so abruptly. And others I've spoken with over the years say it was a big mistake early on not to talk with the Taliban. Still others say the U.S. tried to do too much, rebuild a nation in the image of the U.S. Scott, 6 years ago, I asked an American Army colonel in Kabul what he would have done differently if he had to do it all over. And he paused for a while, looked at the floor, and simply said, plant trees and go home.
NPR correspondent Tom Bowman, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Scott.
And that's Up First for Saturday, May 1st, 2021. I'm Scott Simon.
And I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro. Up First is back Monday with news to start your week. You can follow us on social media. We're at Up First on Twitter.
And for more news, interviews, books, music, just plain fun, you can find us on the radio.
That's Weekend Edition, Saturday and Sunday mornings. Find your NPR station at stations.npr.org.
A few years ago, a website popped up in Stockton, California, and conspiracy theories started ramping way up.
And it's being funded by a conservative movement underneath the table.
And I was like, oh my gosh, you guys, people really believe this.
What happens when the local news outlet isn't fact-checking conspiracy theories, maybe encouraging them? Listen now from NPR's Invisibilia podcast.